Hello, I'm Bruce Celery. This is Moolala, Money Made Simple. There is a lot of money talk on Twitter these days, literally every minute of every day. But what are people saying? What are they talking about? Why? I will speak to Andrea McDonald, the financial services lead at Twitter, about what some of these insights on social tell us. Buying a home in this market is nutterson nuts. And so there are, of course, entrepreneurs moving in to try and bridge the gap to make it easier for people. Something I have mixed feelings about, but we talked about one fintech called Key recently. We're going to talk about another one called Our Borough. It has a co-ownership model. Alex Corvin from Orboro will be here to talk about how it works. Then all the wisdom you need to help you with your personal finances summarized in one pretty significant book, 700 Witticisms, coming from author Alexander Inaikin. The book is called Applied Wisdom, 700 Witticisms to Save Your Assets. If you have done a lot of online shopping lately or will do over the course of the next 12 months, you probably want to listen up to some of the tips from the forefront of fraud. We're going to talk to Larry Zelvin from BMO Financial Group. He is the head of their financial crimes unit. Plus, the money mechanic is here to talk about his personal finance podcast. It is called FI Garage. This is Moolala, Money Made Simple, brought to you in part by Credit Canada, the first and longest standing nonprofit credit counseling agency in the country, and by Home Equity Bank, provider of the CHIP reverse mortgage. Let's get started. I am always amazed by the advertising that follows me around the internet, annoyed sometimes by what they know, and curious at how they found out what they now know. So any delusion that I had to privacy has been squashed like a frog on a highway. But let's turn the power of that notion, the power of what social media knows, for a little bit of good here. New insights from Twitter show that Canadians are talking more and more about their money on the platform. For more on what they're saying, I'm joined by Andrea McDonald. She is Twitter's financial services lead. Hello there.
Hello. Thank you for having me.
Your latest insights show more people are talking about their personal finances on Twitter. Why do you think that is?
That is right. So I think that we've had quite an interesting year around the world and here in Canada. And it's been very interesting for Canadians. And we've faced, you know, a year of uncertainty as it relates to the economy, housing, or the labor market. And so I think that shift and that uncertainty has really led Canadians to talk more about their finances on Twitter. When you think about Twitter, it's really the conversation layer of the internet. And so what people are talking about in their day-to-day lives is often taking place and, you know, really presenting itself on our platform. What's interesting is that because our data is publicly available, we're able to look at that data and the insights and see those trends as they increase, which is what we're showing today.
What are people talking about when it comes to personal finance? What are the topics? I have a guess on the number one, but I bet you're going to tell me. So here's my guess. My guess is something related to housing.
That is definitely one of the top trends, what people are talking about. And so there's four that we've uncovered, and I can go into each of them. The first is just an overall increase in their investment strategies. And so investing in general has seen a massive increase in conversation. The second, as you guessed it, is housing. You know, we've seen in many parts of Canada, the housing market has never been hotter. There's tons of articles throughout the media speculating on buying trends. And so that's another massive surge in conversation this year. The third is small businesses and small business owners, in fact, just amplifying their voices more on the platform. And then the fourth, which is a very interesting one, is the cryptocurrency conversation, which is an absolute acceleration mode, seeing massive increases over the last year. And we expect that to continue into 2022.
And you have a team now dedicated to crypto. What do they do?
So they're really looking at, you know, objectively what the opportunities are for Twitter around this, you know, decentralization of banking in the world. And so one of the things that the company Twitter has implemented recently is we've created NFT verification. We've also added tipping via Bitcoin. And so those are some of the types of things that Twitter has launched recently. And we can expect to see more to come in this area for sure.
Now, you also have something called the Twitter Sentiment Index. How does that connect to what you're learning on personal finances?
Yeah, absolutely. So we just launched this in partnership with the S&P Dow Jones a couple weeks ago. And so what the Twitter Sentiment Index is, it's a partnership and it takes a look at the top conversation or the top 500 publicly traded companies, as indicated by the S&P Dow Jones, and it looks and tracks their sentiment and creates an index around the Twitter data, as well as the methodology from the S&P Dow Jones. And it can create an index on the companies that are most positively talked about on the platform. And so it's just a really great example of a company leveraging the power of Twitter data. We know that, you know, the conversation on Twitter can impact the stock market. We saw that last year with the GameStop phenomenon, yeah. Right? Like when you literally can see as the tweet volume increases, that stock price increased, right? And so this is just a really clever way of, wow, you know, we know this is happening. We know the conversation is taking place. There's CEOs, journalists, speculators, everyday investors who are really, you know, steering the value of stock prices. This is now an index powered by Twitter data and a methodology from the S&P Dow Jones to create that index, which is really, really cool.
And now, so there's a huge pro to having this conversation flow so freely and easily in the marketplace. And there are some cons too. You mentioned GameStop. There's a bunch of meme stocks. There's a whole lot going on that front. The concern that is out there and that I have is the pump and dump nature of what this technology enables at such a massive, massive scale. How does Twitter navigate that?
You know, I think what the power of Twitter is that it's showcasing, you know, aggregated conversation at scale, right? There's still an absolute onus on the individual investor to make sure that what they're doing is intelligent and that they're making informed decisions. And so I think, you know, there's definitely areas where we can make sure that there's not a spread of misinformation. We're making a ton of progress in that pursuit. There can be, like when we think about the S&P Dow Jones Index, like making sure that we're screening out any information that's not relevant. And so technology and enhancements to it can really make sure that we're filtering out any information that's not going to help enhance. You know, our mission at the company is to serve the public conversation. And that's what we're always going to be trying to aim for.
And can you just describe how it works when you try and manage misinformation? Because anyone can tweet virtually anything out. It can be retweeted a gazillion times in a matter of minutes, depending on how many followers you have. What's the way that you clamp down on that, even highlight that that's inaccurate and then, you know, remove it or mitigate it? Or how does that work?
Yeah, so there's been a couple of tools that we've implemented recently to really help tackle this. The first is we created a prompt that actually prompts our audience before you retweet an article. It'll ask you, hey, wait a minute, have you actually read this article? And so what we found that by adding in that prompt, we reduced the, you know, just retweeting of articles blindly by 33%. And so it's making sure that people aren't just, you know, looking at a headline, a sensationalized headline and retweeting it, which can lead sometimes, you know, not always, obviously, but sometimes to the spread of misinformation. And so that is one tool that we've recently released, which has been really impactful. Another pilot that we are introducing is called Birdwatch, which is a, you know, crowdsourced community managed resource tool that can help us label potentially misinformation articles or tweets. And so we're really looking to the community and to the audience on our platform to help us to tackle and navigate this. And then there's just the simple automation where, you know, we can obviously tell when things are obviously misinformation or obviously, you know, malfunctioned or I can't even think of the word of what I'm trying to say here, but manipulated right. media. When it's so obvious, when we can just detect that through AI. So those are just some of the things that we're doing. Health, we consider this to be health on the platform. When we talk about misinformation, it is the number one priority of our company. And so we've made a ton of investment and progress in this area that we're really proud of.
What are you doing now to prepare for the inevitable market correction? And I ask because I worked in business television in 99, 2000, and whoa, we were the Twitter of the day because we were amplifying all sorts of opinions about hot stocks and all those sorts of things. And there was a real consumer culture around it. Everybody could do it. It was super easy to trade. It is now easier than ever to trade. And it's not so much the business networks that are pushing out these stories. It's social media. So what conversations are you having now to prepare for what is a probable significant market correction? And it could be tomorrow. It could be in 3 years. It's just the way the market works.
Yeah. I think like Twitter's position, you know, again, like we're the conversation layer of the internet. And so we're not steering the conversation. We're not trying to correct or trying to manipulate it in any way. We are trying to offer a platform for speculators, journalists, CEOs who want to make sure that their companies are, you know, seen in a certain light, have a platform and a way to do that. And so what we will continue to do is to make it easier for Canadians and people all around the world to leverage our service to find out what's happening in the world right now. And that can relate to, you know, the financial conversation, which continues to grow. We have seen, you know, 147% increase in the investment conversation alone in Canada. And so we're going to continue to make sure that our service is there and available for Canadians to use so they can get that information, you know, should that market correction happen, that they're able to have the information to make informed decisions. So that would be, you know, my opinion on where Twitter is going to land in that.
Yeah, it's terrifying. It is terrifying to have so many people holding single stocks, most of whom have never lived through a market correction.
Yes. Yeah. It'll be interesting for sure. For sure. But you know, no one knows what's really going to happen. So it'll be interesting to see.
Yes. Andrea, thank you for your time today.
My pleasure.
Andrea McDonald is Twitter's financial services lead.
You're listening to Moolah Law, Money Made Simple, with Bruce Ellery on Canada Talks, Sirius XM 167.
This is an interview about housing affordability, and it is the 14,000th interview on this topic I have done in the last year, at least. But here's the twist. There is another fintech that is blurring the lines between renting and owning, or at least finding different ways to own property that aren't the traditional, okay, I got to save the down payment, I got the mortgage. So recently, we talked to the founders of a company called Key. Today, we're going to talk to the folks behind Our Burrow. And it is a co-ownership model, and you proceed down this path so that you can invest in a home without necessarily having the $200,000 already in the bank to fund it. Alex Corvin is Chief Product Officer for Our Burrow, and she joins us now to tell us how it works. Hello there.
Hi, Bruce. Good to be here.
There have been a number of companies in this space trying to figure out a way around the reality that the down payment needs to be the size of the GDP of Luxembourg in order to own anything anywhere in this country. How does Our Burrow work?
That's a great question. Good to kick off with just the mechanics. So we are a true co-ownership model. We invest in the home alongside the home buyer. So we're different from rent-to-owns or other models that you've spoken to, where the homeowner contributes just this, or the person living in the property contributes just a fraction towards equity. Here, we purchase the property together with that home buyer and have a shared equity model that's proportionate to how much we each contribute towards a down payment. So in that example you use, or you say, you know, somebody needs close to $200,000 for a down payment, which is actually quite true. The average cost of a home is now well over a million, at least here in Toronto. Say in that $200,000 down payment, you come to the table with $50,000. Our Burrow puts $150,000. So you put in a quarter of the down payment and we put in three quarters. We would have a 25-75% equity split in that home. And when I say like true co-ownership, we live and breathe that mandate. And it's more than just getting people into the properties and getting into the market. We are there for you for the entire home ownership journey because of that alignment of incentives around increasing the property value. So there's a lot of like little programs there that makes us quite unique.
I want to paint the kitchen fuchsia. Are you going to veto my vision for a kitchen that is fuchsia, including the marble countertops?
You could have fuchsia marble countertops if you like, and we will not veto these decisions, these aesthetic decisions that you might want to make to your home. When you sell your home, we will have resources and support for you on how to maximize the resale value. So at that, like, you can make the home your own, personalize it and make it the best place for you to live in, because that's what we want our homeowners to feel. But when it's time to sell, you and I both know that we're going to be 100% aligned and getting the most value for your home.
So are you saying fuchsia countertops are not going to sell? Is that,
you know,
is that
what? In 7 years, that could be all the rage, and people will pay a total premium for fuchsia countertops and fuchsia kitchen. So
where does the capital come from? I mean, it seems like almost a scalable version of wealthy parents.
That's so great, because when we first started out, we were playing taglines. We joked about our tagline being the rich parents you wish you had. So the money for us, like a huge part of Arbro's business model is our investment practice. So we have, you know, we have this home buyer facing co-ownership product. We help you buy a home, help you invest, et cetera. But there's this whole back-end operation on the investment side. So we work with accredited Canadian real estate investors, and we pool their funds into a fund that is then deployed alongside the homeowners. So that is where the capital comes from. We go out and we actually raise the capital to be able to deploy into homes.
And anyone who has capital that they're going to put into that pool would expect a return. So what sort of return can they expect?
So they expect a return that's benchmarked to the historical growth prices of residential homes in whatever region we're investing in. And so these are investors. What's interesting about investors actually is that these are folks who may otherwise be investing directly into a property. So they're looking for a rental property, right? And they're trying to get that upside of property appreciation while renting it out. And we've noticed that in the marketplace, like, home buyers who are looking to buy their home to live in are actually competing against these investors. Like, they're bidding against these investors who have no intention of living the property and just want to, like, buy it. And who knows if they even want to rent it out. Some of these investors have no interest in renting. They just want to purchase it, park their money there, and then sell it in 5 years when the property appreciates. So we're saying, hey, instead of doing that and competing against, like, true, like, legitimate people who want a home for their families to live in, you can invest in our fund, have a diversified portfolio of residential real estate, and still get that same ROI trajectory as you otherwise would.
What's the simple way for us to think about the fees for the person who lives in the home, whatever you call that, the owner who lives there versus the owner who invests? How would you think about those fees?
Yeah, that's a great point. So we'll call them the occupying owner. That's our technical term, but it's the clearest, right? Yep. The occupying owner of the property. So say as the occupying owner in that example I gave earlier, you have a 25% stake in the property. If you co-own this property with a friend and your friend is not living in the property, most likely that friend will be charging you rent for their 75% share, right? So Arbro, we do not charge any rent. There are no fees that you pay to us for the duration of your occupancy in the property. And in lieu of that, we say, well, you know what? You're living in the home. You're enjoying it 100%. It's your responsibility to maintain the home, pay the property taxes, pay the insurance, keep it in good standing. So that's sort of the rationale in answer to your question of around, like, the fees of the cost of home ownership.
Okay. So when there is a major expense, the roof is done, you don't get to call wealthy parents at Arbro and say, I want 75% of the cost to repair that roof. The occupying homeowner pays the full burden.
Yes, the occupying owner is responsible for these maintenance. Having said that, actually, great segue into some of the value add programs. I mentioned right from the beginning that we really live and breathe the principle of being a co-owner. We have programs in place. So as a simple example, every single one of our homeowners have access to a free home maintenance program. So Arbro, we've partnered with a home maintenance company and we pay the cost of semi-annual home maintenance visits on all our properties. So right out of the gate, you've got a head start in terms of home maintenance. You get semi-annual, like, visits and checkups in terms of little things that need to be done, the filters that need to be replaced, et cetera. But this company will also go in and tell you, say, hey, you know what? Look out, there's this, we're seeing some deterioration in the roof. A heads up, you might want to start saving for that. So homeowners are never hit with these surprises and they can plan for that. And then on the other side, if they are hit with a surprise, like furnace breakdown or roof breakdown, they don't have the funds necessary, like readily available for that repair, We also have a program called the Homeowners Advance Fund. It's essentially like a rainy day fund that all of our co-owners have access to, because we know, you know, if there's a leaky roof and they leave that unattended because they don't have the funds, that's going to cause problems for all of us down the road in terms of property value. So we have these little, I mean, those are just two examples of some of the features. But like I said, a big part of our product offering is the support that we can provide homeowners once they're in the home.
How do you qualify the occupier and the type of home? Because I can imagine you'd be less interested in a crack house in a terrible neighborhood.
I don't know. Do they have fuchsia countertops?
They will. If I'm owning the crack house, they will 100%. People can do the lines of cocaine on mirrors on the fuchsia countertops. That's, I guess, a coke and crack.
That's a different podcast.
That shows how limited my knowledge of illicit drugs are. So, but how does that work? How do you vet those two pretty significant variables, the occupying owner and the home?
For sure. So we start before people even start looking for a property. So this is bringing that investment practice back into the conversation. Our investment team looks at the high growth areas around the GTA. We've identified specific regions that have historically shown great resilience towards, you know, market factors and downturns, et cetera. So we start with those regions first. And then our portfolio, and we have like a portfolio mandate. There's certain diversifications we want to meet in terms of, you know, build form. So our portfolio will have a certain percentage of single detached properties, certain percentage of condos. So within these regions and within these built forms, we sort of pre-vet properties. And buyers who work with us can actually use our search platform. So that when they're looking at properties on our search platform, they know that all the properties that are shown to them are already the ones that are within our investment mandate. And beyond that, like, we know that if you are a homeowner and you are truly committed to living in this property, making it the best place for yourself, well, most likely this is going to be a good place for somebody else to live in down the road as well, right? So we're not, that's a fundamental like principle, is our interests are 100% aligned in that regard, both in selection and like property maintenance.
Really interesting stuff. Alex, thank you for joining us today.
That was great. That was easy.
Easy breezy. Alex Corvin, Chief Product Officer for Our Borough. I don't know what she expected. She thought I was going to be like strapped to the rack and horrendous. No, it's me. I'm the friendliest personal finance person in Canada. Thank you so much, Alex.
No problem. Thanks, Bruce. Take care.
Moolah La, Money Made Simple is brought to you in part by Credit Canada. I am the CEO of the organization, and we're Canada's longest standing nonprofit credit counseling agency. Our mission is to help people get out of debt so they can get back into life. And we have so much going on for Financial Literacy Month. Go to creditcanada.com/FLM, and you're going to learn about our free virtual events, our webinars, access all sorts of tools. If you are feeling overwhelmed by the debt you are carrying, go to creditcanada.com and book an appointment, or find our phone number and call us. One of our accredited counselors is going to talk you down and tell you about the various options that you have. You do have options, I promise you. Moolah La is also sponsored by Home Equity Bank, the provider of the CHIP reverse mortgage. Here's the big idea. It empowers Canadian homeowners age 55 plus to live retirement on their terms by providing them with a safe and easy way to access the equity built up in their home. And given the prices of houses these days, that equity can be considerable. The funds can be used for whatever the client wants or whatever the client needs. And that could be travel, it could be helping grandchildren, or it could be supplementing their day-to-day expenses. You can access up to 55% of your home's value with no monthly mortgage payments required. Go to chip.ca to learn how you can stay in the home you love without having to move or downsize. That's Home Equity Bank. Coming up next on Moolah La, a new book called Applied Wisdom, 700 Witticisms to Save Your Assets. And later, what's in fashion for fraudsters? The latest trends from those hoping to help you part with your money. Don't forget, we've got a newsletter. You can sign up at moolahla.ca. It's got all sorts of fun stuff from CBC Radio and CityLine and BNN Bloomberg and all that kind of stuff.
Hi, it's me, your debt. Look, we need to talk. This isn't working. The missed payments, the collection calls, and all those sleepless nights. We need nonprofit debt counseling, and I found the perfect place. Credit Canada Debt Solutions. They're non-judgmental, 100% confidential. They'll negotiate with creditors and even stop interest. Don't you want to rebuild your credit? You deserve better.
Break up with debt. Visit creditcanada.com.
You're listening to Moolah La, Money Made Simple with Bruce Ellery on Canada Talks, Sirius XM 167.
There are some lessons you can only learn for yourself. For example, don't use a carving knife to separate frozen salmon burgers. I knew that, but I really didn't learn my lesson until I had successfully severed the tendons in my right hand. Other lessons you actually can learn from other people. Pay yourself first, take advantage of compound interest, all that kind of stuff. Our next guest has assembled a good selection of wisdom that relates to money. Alexander Inaikin collected hundreds of quotes from really smart people over the course of the past couple of decades and put them all together in a book. It is called Applied Wisdom, 700 Witticisms to Save Your Assets. Now, ASS bracket, ETS bracket. He joins us now from Zug, Switzerland to talk about it. Hello there.
Hello, everyone. Hi, Bruce.
What got you started? Why did you decide you're, instead of bottle caps or matchbooks or stamps, you decided you would collect wisdom?
Well, I sort of like started writing when I joined the research department about like late 80s. I was sort of like the junior at the desk, and no one wanted to write all these articles about, you know, options and stocks for the local newspapers. So I got to do that, and I found myself enjoying it. And to spice things up, I started using these quotes, and I got a lot of feedback based on these quotes. Obviously, the idea was to add content. But I also got positive feedback from these witticisms or you know, like witty quotes. So I started collecting them, and you know, and over the past, I don't know, 10 years, I put them in a book.
What makes a good quote? What makes a good wittyism? Because I'm sure, like stamps, there are some that are more valuable than others.
Well, I think nearly always if it like a joke or a cartoon contains an element of truth and an element of something which is sort of like true but politically incorrect to say, and I think that makes a good witticism, and you know, some people were really good at it, like Mark Twain, Winston Churchill, just to name two, Albert Einstein as well.
I'm not going to force you to have an absolute favorite, but give me one of your favorites.
I think it comes from Warren Buffett when he says risk comes from not knowing what you're doing. I think that would be. I've got a top ten in my book, but that's really high, yeah, on the list.
You cluster them in the book in a bunch of different, I don't know, categories, including a category called the Iron Law of Failure. What would I learn, you know, going through some of the quotes in that section?
Well, I think it's the idea is from a British economist who wrote a book called Why Everything Fails. And what he found is that there's order in failure, like with stars, planets, but also on Earth with biospheres. And then he found that in economies, with companies and countries, empires, there's a similar relationship. But in the end, everything fails. And I think that as an investor, if you participating in a trend, you know it's going to end. At one day, you just might not know when. But I think it's a healthy attitude. To know that if things are going well for you, it might not last.
Applied wisdom, you write, is the avoidance of folly, faux sophistication, dogma, stupidity, ignorance, arrogance, hubris, and includes doubt, skepticism, and a healthy baloney detection approach. You must have developed that baloney detection approach in your years in research. What's your own personal wisdom about that? Quotes aside.
Well, I think as an investor, you need to know the incentive of someone talking to you or someone pitching to you. And typically, if you understand the concept of asymmetric information, you know that the person who's pitching to you has other information than you. Then I think it's good to be skeptical. And then, in some cases, you recognize that if it's baloney, you recognize it. I think that comes with the years. I would guess it's a process of maturing over time.
Well, speaking about over time, I think this one from John Kenneth Galbraith really only can be earned within the fullness of time. And it leads your Gump's Law chapter. One of the greatest pieces of economic wisdom is to know what you do not know. It seems almost impossible for a 20-year-old to really act upon that or even have cognizance of what that might mean. Much easier for someone in their 50s and 60s who has, seen the world as it is and how it unfolds.
I would full-heartedly agree with that, and I think there is a large part of the book is about learning by doing, and I think the investment, like the craft which we call investment management, is something you learn by doing, and I think there's no other way. Obviously, it's much more noble. I mean, I quote people like Confucius or Bismarck, who sort of like say it's much more noble to learn from others, from the mistakes others do, which is obvious, but I'm not sure it works like that. And I'm 54, so I believe I've made so many mistakes that, but you learn, you know. Mm.
The now casting approach, I don't even know what that word means.
It's a bit of a pun between forecasting and now. So because so many things in the social sciences are chaotic. Chaotic meaning a small trivial disturbance can have a large effect. It's very difficult to forecast, and also a lot of the hard economic data is published with a big delay, and so instead of forecasting, you do now casting, which means you have an assessment which is real time today, rather than either believing someone's forecast or waiting until hard data is published by whoever.
I referenced wisdom being earned over periods of time. We find ourselves today in the longest bull market in recorded history. And so for investors who've never experienced the financial crisis or the dot-com boom and bust, it must be very difficult for them to even conceive of a world, in a real visceral way, to conceive of a world in which stocks do not go up.
Yeah, I think what is important that your universe, your investment universe, is not just stocks. And then if you have a broad view over commodities, bonds, real estate, if need be, wineries, if you're sort of like in depending on which bracket you're in.
Did you say wineries?
Like wine.
Like wine as an investment, or wine, winery as a real estate.
Wine yards, for example, some investors are now in, or not now. They always have been like art. These are sort of like alternatives. It's not, yes, not something, you know. But the point is that there's a very in a bull market like now. There's an extremely strong focus on what is going up the most, like technology stocks, for example. But I remember the late 1980s when I started in the business, the main index on the planet was the Nikkei 225, right? And now the S&P 500 has that status. It's the same, or at least there is a parallel. So there is a hindsight bias in a sense that we tend to focus what has gone up a lot, but that might not necessarily be where the opportunities are.
Very interesting stuff. Well, thank you for pulling it all together. 700, that's a lot of witticisms. And thank you for joining us to talk about it.
It was a pleasure. Thank you, Bruce.
Alexander Inaiken is the author of Applied Wisdom, 700 Witticisms to Save Your Assets. He was in Zug, Switzerland today. Stay with us. Coming up later, we'll talk to the money mechanic about a personal finance podcast called FI Garage. But first, protecting yourself from cyber crimes while you're shopping online. Larry Zelvin from BMO Financial Group will share his tips. If you have missed an episode of this show, super simple to catch up. You go to moolala.ca. You can look at full episodes, or you can search by topic or by guest. So, get caught up, will ya? Get caught up already.
You're listening to Moolah La, Money Made Simple with Bruce Ellery on Canada Talks, Sirius XM 167.
Staying at home in your pajamas, shopping from the comfort of your computer can be so much easier in many ways, unless you have to do a return because it didn't fit. But there is a trade-off. With all that online shopping and all that credit card usage, there is an increase in exposure to cybercrimes, right? And other various online scams and all that. So how do you stay safe when you're shopping on the internet? Larry Zelvin is the head of the financial crimes unit at BMO Financial Group, and he joins us now with some of his tips. Hello, Larry.
Hello, Bruce.
I read that as he's head of financial crimes, and I thought, probably a much more interesting job than the job you hold, but not the job you hold.
Yeah, no, Bruce. And honestly, it'd probably be a lot more profitable, but the risks yeah. are far greater. So I'm going to stick with this gig, I think.
Stick with fighting the crimes. I think that's a good idea. What would you say makes someone a good target for a cyber crime?
Yeah, I'll tell you, Bruce, there's a couple of things. Targets are usually people or organizations that present the greatest opportunity. And by that, I mean that they don't present a lot of friction. So if you are not updating your phone or your iPad or your desktop device, right, as you see those every now and again, you have these really annoying things saying, you know, your software is out of date or your applications are out of date. That puts you at greater risk. One of the other things that puts you really at risk is by answering emails or phone calls from groups or individuals you don't know. A lot of folks get taken because they are targeted. We call this social profiling. So in some cases, it's specific. In some cases, it's more general. They may have picked up your name because you were shopping in certain areas and they've compromised that organization and they have your email and phone and they're contacting you, say, hey, you know, you're our customer and we have this great value and this great opportunity. You know, we'd like you to, you know, give us your name, username and password, and we can help you, access your website and do this great shopping deal at much lower price. Or if something's out of stock, we'll get it to you faster, or they'll get you on the phone and convince you. So, you know, there's a lot of ways they can reach out to you, but ultimately it is really about their ability to trick you, and they can get your name in many, many different ways. And so we're all being targeted.
What is one example of a type of fraud that is common now that wouldn't have been even a year or two ago? So it may not have the same volume as the same old, you know, phishing and the gift cards and all that, but we've talked about many of those for a long period of time. What's new? What have we talked less about?
So one of the new ones is happening actually with Zelle, an online payment transfer. And this is not a Zelle fault in any way, shape or form. It's impacting a lot of companies, but this one has made the news. So what is happening is a fraudster will call pretending to be the customer and said, hey, I've forgotten my my password and can you resend it to me? And then what they'll do is they'll say, look, we'll send you a one-time password to your phone, put that in, you know, the website, and you can change your password from there. They go, great, thank you so much. They will now call that customer, that individual they're targeting, and go, hi, I am from, in this case, Zelle. We just sent you a one-time password. Could you please read it back to us because we're having a problem with your account? So unfortunately, people will pass that to the fraudster. They'll use the one-time password. They'll change the password. The customer hangs up, and now the fraudster has access to your account, and now they're off stealing your money.
You got a whole bunch of tips. One is limit online shopping to well-known and reliable retailers. What's, you know, like that, that could not sound more anti-small business. Come on.
The last thing I want to come across is anti-small or medium business, because there is nothing further from the truth.
What I would
say is that if you're, but what I would say is, look, if you're going to go to a smaller, medium-sized business, particularly if you're going to use their website, I'd encourage you to do some homework. You can use the Better Business Bureau. You can Google those sites. You can use social media and see if anybody's complaining, seeing if any, if there are any fraud alerts or if there are any imposter alerts. You've got to look at the website's URL, that www, right, and make sure it makes sense. And then, so, you know, do some homework, because regret is one of the worst human emotions. So if you do your homework and you really are, you know, certain that these folks are reliable and they have what you want and need, by all means, proceed. But if there's any doubt, don't.
Tip number three for you. So two is, you know, question unbelievably good deals. Got it. Tip three is avoid public Wi-Fi. How realistic do you really think that is?
Oh, it is incredibly realistic. And it's particularly realistic around coffee shops, around hotels.
I don't mean realistic that people can find public Wi-Fi. It is so common. I mean realistic that people will prevent themselves from hopping on Wi-Fi instead of churning through their data.
No, look, I've had this conversation with my own children, right? And because they're like, you know what? I go on public Wi-Fi and it's not necessarily about the cost. It's more about the speed, right?
Right.
But the problem is that fraudsters will set up their own hotspot, their own Wi-Fi. And, you know, let's say I'm going to just make a generic name so I don't get in trouble with anybody. But let's say I'm at Coffee Shop X. And coffee shop.
That was very creative. I think we should start a coffee shop named X.
Yeah, no, it's also protects me from legal liability.
True.
And as long as there isn't a coffee shop X. But at the end of the day, you'll create a Wi-Fi that says, you know, coffee X1. And look, you'll go, great, I got great Wi-Fi signal. It's like through the roof. I'm going to use that one. But you're actually connecting through a fraudster's laptop or one of their electronic devices. So everything you're doing, to include your username, your password, is all going through their computer, being logged, and they've captured it. And it's really sad how many dozens, if not hundreds of people they can capture in a matter of hours by being a Wi-Fi site that is not legitimate.
Use mobile payment apps is another tip there. What do you mean by that? What's an example of that?
Well, you've got a number of, so example is you have Zelle, you have a couple of others out there.
Apple Pay, is that?
Exactly. Apple Pay is great. They have great security controls. But again, you've got to be careful, because I would go with the ones that are really reliable, because there are others out there that are pretending to be mobile payment apps. And again, they are fraud. They're actually fraudsters that are trying to move your money, and they'll give you better deals. But right now, mobile payment apps like Apple Pay give you great security. Shopify or some of the others that I would also recommend. Mm.
Your last tip, be sure to check your bank statements regularly. This one, I know it's mom and apple pie. I know it's equivalent to drink 8 glasses of water every day, but I probably catch something every 3 months on my bank statements.
Wow.
I do. Yeah. Including I had 2 subscriptions to Spotify, one which was being some person was very grateful that I hadn't noticed for, by the way, I didn't notice for a year that I had been paying a fraudster for Spotify. They were somewhere in Scandinavia.
Oh, wow. Mm-hmm. Yeah, no, that's not uncommon. I'll tell you, Bruce, I mean, a lot of this stuff we can capture due to our security investments, but they're not perfect and never will be. A lot of the times our customers are the first ones to report it to us. And the faster folks can do that, the faster we can react, and hopefully the faster we can recover your money. What's really becomes more problematic is as you find out a week, 2 weeks, or a month after, it's been moved so many times, we couldn't find it even if we tried. So if you check your accounts regularly, and I will tell you that when it comes to using my credit card, my debit card, I actually get an alert on my phone. Especially if it crosses certain thresholds of like $500 or whatever I have it set on, I don't even recall. But having those alerts can make the difference between having a really bad fraud day and not.
Larry, I appreciate your time.
Bruce, thank you so much. I really appreciate the opportunity to talk to you and your listeners, and you know, welcome the opportunity to engage with you all again.
Larry Zelvin is the head of the Financial Crimes Unit at BMO Financial Group. And here's my two cents. If you are someone who has seniors in your life, it could be parents, aunts, uncles, this is not to say that they aren't fully with it. But when Larry was talking about demographics, that is a particularly ripe group of people because they don't necessarily have their software updated. They're not necessarily on point on the scams du jour. So be kind, reach out, work it into the conversation, and that will be your contribution to the universe. Stay with us. Coming up next, highlighting a Canadian personal finance podcast called FI Garage. It really should be called, I don't know, Beer of the Day, because they drink a lot. I am the I'm the money columnist for a TV show called City Line. It is a lifestyle show. You would probably know what it is. It's been in the air for like 12,000 years. But if you have an interest in finding out more about money on television, go to cityline.tv and search for me.
You're listening to Moolah La, Money Made Simple with Bruce Ellery on Canada Talks, Sirius XM 167.
All right, I got one for you. What happens when an accountant, an economist, and a money mechanic walk into a garage? Well, I will say, spoiler alert, what you get is a really interesting podcast. It's hilarious. These guys clearly know each other and like each other. They're focused on personal finance, but they're also kind of grounded in this, the FIRE movement you've probably heard about, we've talked about on this show. Today, we are going to talk to Money Mechanic, the Money Mechanic himself, and he is joining us to talk about the FI Garage podcast. He's in Victoria, British Columbia. Hello there.
Bruce, pleasure to be chatting with you today. Thanks for having me
on. Why the secrecy? Do you have some glamorous day job or reputation you need to protect?
I do. It's all about the secrecy. No, I'm actually a helicopter mechanic, so that's where the Money Mechanic moniker comes from. But my my co-host, the economist and the accountant, are in fact employed in those industries. And when we started the podcast a few years ago, we felt it would be appropriate just to stay anonymous at the beginning, just so there was no conflict of interest with their jobs.
Right, right. With your job, less of a risk, but for theirs, I can get it. Now, the two episodes I listened to both included beer references, lots of talk about beer. Why so much beer?
Hey, Bruce, we're Canadian. We love our beer, but let's be honest. The whole thing started with just three buddies hanging out in my garage, having a beer, talking finance, and we finally decided just to get microphones. So we continue that through, and we love that as being part of our theme because it creates that easygoing atmosphere where you feel like you're just hanging out, having a beer with some guys in the garage.
The FI Garage, I assume that stands for financial independence, yes?
Yes, it does.
So where are you on the spectrum of the FIRE movement? There's the dabblers on the one hand, and then there's the people who, you know, reuse paper towel and iron it for another day, and they're bound to determine to retire and live in Middle Earth by the time they're 23. Where are you on the spectrum of intensity on FIRE?
Yeah, that's a great question. And I think I kind of have to admit my age range for that, because I think that has a bit to play into it. I'm in my 40s, so I'm a little less intense because that high intensity, extreme frugality, it just doesn't appeal to me, Bruce. Right. And so, you know, the FI scale from the perspective of the podcast is, I think we try and play the middle ground. We try and talk about intentional spending and spending on what you value, not going to these extreme measures of deprivation and frugality that may work for some, but it's just not our real, we don't toe that line.
What brought you into this world? What was the single defining moment that had you say, I'm going to learn about this. I'm going to talk about this with my friends and I'm going to focus on it.
You know, it was actually working overseas. I had a whole lot of time about 10 years ago sitting around in front of a computer while I was waiting for the helicopter. And I just sort of started learning about, of course, Mr. Money Mustache is a very common one. And it just went down that rabbit hole and realized that I was living a very common, a very normal life that I had nothing to complain about. But, you know, I'd carried some consumer debt. And I just realized I wasn't preparing myself for the future. And so that kind of turned the corner. And then the more I learned and the more I sort of met the community, and that's the best part about this whole personal finance and financial independence journey, is the people you meet, the community you develop, the communication with others, the learning that you can do. And it just kind of set me on the right path. And it's taken a long time. It's not a get rich quick scheme for anybody, but it's been empowering for both my wife and I.
Tell me about some of the topics that you cover on the show, because if I were to just listen to how you've described it thus far, I would think, oh, it's like couponing and, you know, diversified low-cost investing. The level of sophistication, or at least the topics that you cover, is much at a much higher level than that.
Yeah, we don't get into the bare basics of, you know, personal finance. There's some excellent podcasts and coverage of that in Canada already, and we felt that we need a little
like
bit more
me.
Of a niche. Exactly, like you, Bruce. And I do enjoy listening to your show. So there you go. But no, we wanted to be a little more niche. And because the three of us, we come to it with different stages of life, different investing sort of profiles. So we like to get into the weeds a little bit. We'll talk about, you know, different styles of real estate investing, some alternative assets, you know, anything's on the table. But, you know, financial independence isn't just a one way to get there. There's different ways. So we like to kind of explore some of the, you know, fringe areas that people don't talk about a whole lot, and maybe tie that together with how they're optimizing their life to bring in some alternatives rather than just, you know, people going, okay, we're only going to buy dividend stocks. Well, we agree with some dividend stocks, or some other people say, oh, we're only going to buy index ETFs. You know, we like to bring it all together and explore some of the nuance of adding things together.
One of the episodes, a very recent episode, referenced Epic and real estate and rent and a regulator. What is the simplest way you could describe what the holy heck you were talking about there?
Yeah, well, that's a whole nother show right there. Basically, not going too far into it, but Epic is a real estate company in Saskatoon, which I am invested in. And so I have a vested interest there. And basically, they created a hassle-free landlord program, which appealed to me because so many people think of real estate as cleaning toilets, fixing toilets in the middle of the night, right? Whereas I want to be a hassle-free landlord. So they had some issues recently, but those appear to be resolved as of today when we're recording this, which I'm very happy for because, as I said, I'm invested into it. And the podcast that we released on it was just sort of an update. I got a lot of, as you do, comments from listeners and concerns. So fingers crossed, everything moves forward as planned.
What is the single most relevant or resonant topic you feel like you've ever covered?
Wow.
I know. Great question.
That
so
is a
good.
Great question. I think the single most important is, and we circle back to it a lot of times in different shows, and it becomes down to, you know, sort of optimizing your life. At the beginning of this journey, even if it's a personal finance journey, you know, even if you're in debt or if your net worth is zero or wherever you are, it's just kind of having a look and analyzing where your spending's at and learning how to optimize that and do it from a perspective of enjoyment and power that it's enabling you to move ahead. That's really the underlying most important topic.
If you really were that financial independent, retire early in your 40s and you're not like at the high end in terms of frugality and all that stuff, but when your time comes, when you are financially independent, what are two or three things that will characterize the life you will be leading then that are different than the life you are leading now?
Well, that's a good question too, Bruce, because I am in the process of designing the life that I want to lead. Mm. So you may or may not have heard of CoastFi, and we don't have to go into a lot of that detail, but I've scaled back on my work already because the path to financial independence has given me that choice. So I haven't got like a defining moment where I go, I've been at full-time work fixing helicopters and I go to my retired or my financial independence lifestyle. It's been a longer transition from that. And I am in that stage where I'm making those transitions. So right now it's learning my psychology of the things that do bring me joy. And, you know, I like doing woodwork and fixing, you know, vehicles or whatever. I'm a hands-on type of person. So those are the kind of things I really enjoy doing them. So how do I tie that together with that free time that I have? So it's a great question. And it's a really hard one. I think it's one that people really need to understand because you can't just give up and leave something and have nothing to go to.
You mentioned your wife. What does she think about all this? Is she just happy to have you out of the house in the garage periodically?
Yeah, well, especially with all this work from home, and we had to compete for this meeting. She's like, well, I got a meeting coming up too, you know. So
I hope you drop my name. Bruce Ellery is much more important than whatever you could possibly have in your calendar.
That's true, but she does work for the Canadian Hydrographic Service. And as you know, in British Columbia, there's a lot of water issues right now.
All right, fair.
No, she, you know what? She was a little reticent about the whole fire, you know, thoughts at the beginning, because like a lot of us, we jump into it and like all on the bandwagon, you're all in, you're turning off the tap because they're using too much water. Like it's ridiculous. But as you scale back on that and realize you can optimize your life, she became really empowered. She now does her own DIY investing. So that was really helpful for her, because as I learned, we shared and talked about it. And I think we're much closer and we deal with our finances more effectively because we both understand the path that we're on and kind of like the long-term destination.
Nice. And does she drink beer?
Of course. Of course. That's why we make our own beer at home. It's the best.
Match made in heaven. Money Mechanic, thank you for joining us today.
Such a pleasure, Bruce. Thanks so much for having me.
Name withheld. Money Mechanic is the moniker. The podcast is called FI Garage, as in Financial Independence Garage. He joined us from Victoria, British Columbia. That is our show for today. Big thanks to our sponsors, Credit Canada, the longest standing and actually first nonprofit credit counseling agency in the country, and Home Equity Bank, provider of the CHIP reverse mortgage. If you want to stay up to date on all things Moolala, and of course you do, because why wouldn't you? All you have to do is subscribe to our newsletter. It is it comes once a month, brings together things from all sorts of different places, and you can sign up for that at moolala.ca. If you have thoughts, feelings, questions, comments, beer recommendations, you can send them to ask@moolala.ca, and I'll pass them on to the purveyors of that podcast, because I'm a total lightweight when it comes to beer. On social, at Bruce Selry on Twitter, Bruce Selry Moolala on Facebook. Thanks for joining us, and have a great day.